Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. It is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. It is Monday evening. Extraordinary scenes today at the Zondo Commission. We'll reflect on those in just a moment. We'll also pick up tonight on the huge moves around markets with the a new drug emerging as a possible contender for worldwide use. And that is a huge breakthrough. It's another huge breakthrough. The outcome of a drug by those nice people at Moderna. They are saying that their drug is 95% effective after Pfizer came out with the drug saying it was 90% effective. But look, progress is progress, and progress is being made, and it's nice to see. It's going to take an awfully long time for you and I to get hold of a dose, though. So, let's not count our chickens before they're hatched. It's not something that the CEO of Astral Foods ever does. He's very cautious about counting his chickens. We'll talk to Chris Skitter this evening all about those results and the huge additional costs that came to bear, not only from COVID, but lots of stuff that was in the wings already in terms of failing municipalities and all sorts of other really concerning issues when it comes to South African infrastructure. We'll chat tonight also to the chief executive of Vodacom, and that is Shamil Jussup. They saw a huge increase in Vodacom's data usage. And also tonight, I can't wait for this one. This is going to be our book review tonight. Ian Mann from Gateway's Business Consultants loves books, loves business books, and is absolutely enamored by Tim Harford's latest book, How to Make the World Add Up. Boy, if there was ever a need for a book like that, it's now.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk to Justice Zak Yacoub in a second, former Constitutional Court judge. Also to Genevieve Quintal, the political editor at Business Day. As we saw Advocate Musi Sikhakane take to the stand today to defend his client, Jacob Zuma, and saying that Jacob Zuma has all kinds of issues and all kinds of concerns about the State Capture Commission. Plus, of course, Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. He wants Zondo to recuse himself. Just have a listen to Advocate Musi Sikhakane.
You know, if we were playing the Stalingrad, everyone thinks Stalingrad means a delay. Stalingrad was the shortest battle. It was just fought strategically. Is this, if you blow us today, you don't agree with us, as I said, I have a mountain to climb, what happens? Do we get Mr. Zuma here as a guarantee? No, if we approach it that way, we will just, even if we lose, we will review you. We will go as far as wherever, and that's not helpful. If you force me to bring him here without the climate being created for him to believe that he's not being charged, well, I'll put him there, Chair, and he'll exercise his right to say nothing.
That is Advocate Musi Sikhakane this afternoon at the Zondo Commission. Watching that very closely, Genevieve Quintal, political editor at Business Day. He was never going to roll over and accept being subjected to the sort of cross-examination we've seen so many people put through at the Zondo Commission. Was he, Genevieve?
No, absolutely not, Bruce. I find it strange that Musi Sikhakane, well, I guess they say this all the time, that they're not using a Stalingrad tactic, but they are. You know, we're 4 months from the end of this commission, and it's been a year since, or more than a year since, the former president appeared for the first time before ahead of the commission, and here we are again, him still fighting not to have to go sit in that chair and actually answer questions.
I mean, is there any merit in the argument, in your opinion, as a political editor, somebody who's watched this very, very closely, as to the argument saying that there is an element of bias here? I mean, I struggle to see it. I don't know if you struggle to see it.
I also struggle to see it. You know, bias, and it came down to comments that the Chief Justice had made during the commission, thanking someone for coming to give their testimony, saying, oh, okay, well, did you not think that maybe this, you know, questioning them and sort of engaging with them, and they see this as him almost, leaning towards believing whoever's giving him the testimony, and they want him to sort of sit there and just listen. But as Paul Pretorius said earlier, this isn't a court case. There's no real accused. This is an inquiry, and in an inquiry, it's up to the judge or the presiding officer to ask the questions, to probe people, to give alternative ideas. Well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, to really come to a decision on what happened here.
Yeah, and the extraordinary position that has been taken, well, you can force us to come, but then we just won't give you anything. Thank you, Genevieve Quintal. Justice Zak Yacoob joins us now, former Constitutional Court judge. What does it take, Justice Yacoob, what does it take for a judge to be forced to recuse themselves? Just how serious does a conflict of interest need to be?
The law is very clear that a reasonable person, and it's not a subjective test, it's an objective one. It is not what the witness concerned or the person concerned feels. But if a reasonable person in the position of the person making the application for a recusal comes to reasonably and with knowledge of all the facts, reasonably could come to the conclusion that there would be problems in relation to the impartiality of the judge concerned, then obviously the judge must recuse himself. So there's a double requirement of reasonableness. It must be a reasonable person, objectively, not what Jacob Zuma or anyone else feels. And then it is a question of that too must be a reasonable opinion with knowledge of all the facts. And the facts that are important here is that Raymond Zondo has been a good judge and has been a wonderful judge for a very, very long time. He has been the Deputy Chief Justice, not for nothing. And as far as I'm concerned, without prejudging the application, I think that what he decides in this case will be right. My own view is that if he comes to the conclusion that he is not conflicted, we should accept it. I think that everyone should have the discipline of accepting it. There's a little threat in the argument that they will review it forever and go to the highest court in the land. That everyone does to review proceedings to gain time and to make sure that the thing is postponed as much as possible. But let's hope that the courts will respond to this challenge and deal with these so-called threatened reviews properly.
The threat will take it under review forever. And even if you do manage to get me to force him to come here, he'll just sit there and plead the Mieni. I mean, Duda Mieni sat there refusing to answer basic questions. And it turns out to be an awful waste of time. Under those sorts of circumstances, what is the value then of a witness appearing other than for the commission to be able to say, we invited them, we asked them questions, they refused to answer, therefore the only conclusion we can draw is that they are possibly implicated in X, Y, and Z as per witnesses 1 to 500 or whatever the case might be.
So my own view is rather radical on that. I think that commissions of inquiry are an offered solution for what should really be. So what happens is that commissions of inquiry are appointed and people think that something is happening and they think that everything will be fine. And to the extent that commissions of inquiry end up delaying criminal proceedings, I think it's a huge problem and they don't really work. And I really think the real answer is that the criminal prosecution people must not wait for the end of the commission. They must do their own work. The real thing is that people against whom there is evidence must be prosecuted. Now, that evidence must be gathered by the police and the prosecution. The fact that the police and the prosecution are compromised is a little bit of a trouble. But I still think that commissions of inquiry don't achieve anything really. And this is no criticism of Raymond Zondo or anything. He was asked to do it. He did it, and that is fine. But I have a fundamental problem with commissions of inquiry used in an effort to comfort the public and make the public believe that somebody has done right, when in the end, the only real answer is effective criminal proceedings.
Absolutely. I mean, that has got to be the outcome, finally, of this entire process. Otherwise, it is truly a billion rand down the drain. I mean, there was criticism today of how long the process was taking, how much money was being spent on it. And Jacob Zuma's attorney...
Sorry, debate with you. Not finally, please. Sooner rather than later, not at the end.
Yeah, now. Okay. Absolutely. No, I cannot wait. But African Muzi Sikakani almost suggesting that Jacob Zuma was bullied into starting the commission, almost suggested that he didn't appoint Zondo, he was forced to appoint Zondo by the public protector. He's almost admitting there that he made a terrible judgment choice, and he was pushed into doing things he didn't want to do, which kind of underlies some of the accusations being made about him at the commission and elsewhere, that he was often bullied and pushed into doing things that perhaps he might not otherwise have done. It's an extraordinary submission, would you say?
Well, I think he would have said that whoever he appointed, it is now appropriate for him and to his advantage to say what he is saying. And unfortunately, most people in the world, and Jacob Zuma is normally not an exception. I hope I am an exception. But he will say what is to his advantage and what is not to his detriment to get maximal advantage. And we must not be surprised by all of that.
I don't believe that you anticipate that there will be a recusal, that we will now go through the next stage in whatever process this commission has to go through to get Jacob Zuma to appear. But your argument is, whatever is happening in the commission, actually, the hawk should be, the hawks in the National Prosecuting Authority should be doing a parallel process to get this justice served as quickly as possible.
Absolutely. But I don't want to affect the process affect it negatively by making a comment. I'm a retired judge, and I don't want to make a comment on how I think the Deputy Chief Justice will decide the issue. All I want to say is that I will have the discipline, even as one of his colleagues and as a retired judge. Whatever he decides, I'll have the discipline to say his decision is right, because he is, by all accounts, an honest person, and anyone who doubts that decision would actually be quite wrong in my view. So whatever he decides, I will accept without question.
Justice Zak Yacoob, thank you. Former Constitutional Court Judge. I think that answers the question loud and clear. What we're also seeing in the real world, not in the sideshow that is the Zuma appearance today at the Zondo Commission, because it is a sideshow in a much bigger crisis of confidence in the country. And that is, contributing. I mean, the Zuma years are a massive contributing factor to the economic malaise we find ourselves in now. The onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, already a weak economy, an economy on its knees. And then COVID-19 got us into lockdowns. Lockdowns got us into corporate failures. And according to Eric Levenstein, who joins us now from Johannesburg, director at Worksmen's Attorneys, it has been an extraordinary year for business rescue. How many business rescue cases are currently running, Eric?
So, good evening, Bruce. We've got reports from SIPSI, the company's office, to tell us that there's been about 233 filings so far this year, majority in Gauteng, followed by the Western Cape and in KZN. And I think it's just a reflection of the economy where we've come from since March. And it continues. There's no doubt about it that we haven't seen the end of that cycle. And I think after the Christmas period, depending how busy people are and how busy businesses are, we might see further fallout early next year as well. But when you look back over the year, I mean, we really have seen some major, major players go into business rescue. When you go back to December a year ago, SA, of course, we've had SA Express, we've had Comair, we've had Edcon, we've had Pumalela, and we've had Busby, and there have been others as well. So, it's been very active, and it's kept, restructuring lawyers, restructuring practitioners, and business rescue practitioners pretty busy.
It most certainly has. I mean, what does it tell us about the health of the sector? Just how many of these companies are returning? SAA is not going to come back in a form we will recognise, nor will SA Express. Comair might, and Busby may continue to play hide and seek. But I wonder just how many of these companies are going to come out of this crisis. A lot of them in serious trouble long before the crisis began and probably should have gone into business rescue sooner.
Yeah, well, I think for a lot of these companies, they're probably teetering on the brink when you go back to March of this year. And I think there was a need for a reset in a lot of these companies in any event from a financial distress perspective. And I think the lockdown, to a large degree, just pushed those over the edge and into this formal business rescue process. But what is interesting is that M&A transactions and business rescue, from what I've seen, this year has been incredibly buoyant. I mean, if you actually look back and look at the TFG deal at Jetstores, for Jetstores and Edcon, the SA Express provisional liquidators, I think, are still negotiating offers and asset sales in that particular business liquidation. Now, it was in rescue. And then, SA, who knows where that'll end up? I mean, there's a lot of money being put in there, and there's always talk about a private equity deal, but not that we've seen much of it. We have seen Deloitte being appointed there to consider potential buyers for SAA. Comair certainly is going through an M&A transaction. Hopefully that will literally land and then hopefully take off by 1 December. And then Pumalela Gaming and Leisure as well was done through a business rescue process, and where we've seen massive money put into the horse racing and gambling industry in South Africa. So I think it's been buoyant, and I think a lot of players who are looking to invest in distressed assets are starting to see the manner in which this can be done in the formal business rescue process. And yes, it's 8 months down the line, but you can have an upside at the end of the day.
I certainly hope so. Eric Levinstein, thank you. Director at Worksman's Attorneys. There are lots of companies. When in bad times, bad companies die. In good times, then you can hide away all kinds of nefarious activity and all kinds of weaknesses. But in bad times, you shake the tree and the bad companies fall out. And then it gives an opportunity to good companies to buy the best bits of the old companies. And in so doing, you get to this sort of recycling, if you like, of companies. So it's not all a complete travesty. Today also, 15 countries forming the world's biggest trading bloc. This was interesting, covering nearly a third of the global economy. It's absolutely huge. Neither the UK nor the United States, by the way, is in this deal, nor any European countries, because it's 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as South Korea, China, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand. So that corner of the globe, broadening China's really impressive influence in that region. And excluding the US, of course, President Donald Trump has sought to distance the US from China. And I wonder whether or not Joe Biden's going to have any greater pull in getting the sorts of trade deals that we see negotiated today by this new trading bloc, this Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. They're calling it RCEP.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Arthur Karras, a portfolio manager of Macro Solutions at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Nothing like a vaccine to get everybody buying shares again, Arthur. It's been an amazing week. This time last week, we were celebrating Pfizer's breakthrough. And today, of course, it's Moderna.
Absolutely. And I think it's giving people a bit of hope that we're going to have a more normal environment in the future, and hence giving the markets a significant boost.
It's a massive boost, and it's also possibly an unrealistic boost, because nobody's talking about exactly when these drugs are going to be available, and certainly not at scale. And you wonder whether this market is, buying the hype for now and won't later sell the fact when the delays become apparent.
Well, we actually have had a massive month already. So if you just look at what the month has done, it's been a very, very strong performance on the back of the election in the US, on the back of two vaccines now being released. But I think very importantly, as you're pointing out, the reality is that the simple logistics of getting these vaccines to everybody out there is quite a big deal. And in the case of the first one, I haven't seen the details of the Moderna one yet, but in the case of the Pfizer one, just simply the issues of people needing two jabs and the fact that it needs to be kept at very, very cold temperatures suggest that the logistics challenge is going to be as big to overcome as the medical challenge, especially developing the vaccine.
Exactly right. It's we're on a long and winding road. You may not have had time this evening, but Prosus and Naspers have come out with a trading update in the last few minutes. Prosus expecting earnings for 6 months to be up 22.7%. I suppose we knew that the Prosus and Naspers updates would be good because the Tencent update was good. And if the Tencent update is good, it kind of means that Naspers is going to be absolutely fine because it is most of the business.
It is. The critical thing there, however, is that we know what the Tencent results are going to be or what the Tencent impact on Naspers is going to be. The issue that we're very focused on is non-Tencent businesses inside Naspers. Those businesses have been burning cash for a number of years, and the shareholders are looking for a sign that that cash burn is easing, that those businesses are able to show that they're on a path to profitability. And that's the critical difference between the Naspers results with a non-Tencent portion within Naspers.
Yeah, that'll be the detail that we'll have to look at in the next few days. What about Vodacom's results today? I mean, data demand up 83%. It's nuts. But I suppose that when you lock people up at home with a smartphone, they're going to trawl the internet courtesy of the data that's available.
And work. I think in many cases, companies have had to send all of their staff home, and not everyone has the benefit of uncapped high-speed broadband. And a lot of companies have gotten around that by simply buying data bundles for their staff and saying, go work from home, here's a data bundle, go and do your thing. So I think that has been a big impact. So both people staying at home, watching Netflix, playing games online. That's also a lot of people working from home and funded by their employers, who want them to be able to function while the office is shut. So some of that is probably going to reduce over time, and it's just a bit of a boost for the company. The real thing, I think, to not lose sight of is that they've yet again, given the dividend a very strong boost. And that just shows what the company is. It's able to generate cash, pay out a healthy dividend, keep growing its business. So for the shareholders who are looking for a good yield that's growing, Vodacom has certainly delivered on that.
And ShopRite, looked like a very disappointing trading update today. Lots of moving pieces, of course. Rand strength impacting some of the returns from other parts of the African continent for ShopRite. Complicated update. What was the big view on that one? The helicopter view, for want of a better term?
I think the issues there are really Africa and liquor. So both of those are a drag on the results. And I think also perhaps the fact that they had done well in the early stages of COVID and kind of giving people reassurance that this was a defensive business. And I think the expectations are just a little bit too high. And they're still earning a reasonable amount of their income from Africa, which is affected by COVID and weak currencies. And I think this is more a case of just simply not meeting people's high expectations.
Thank you to Arthur Karras, Portfolio Manager of Macro Solutions at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Arthur Karras this evening, as the Rand strengthens by 2% against the US dollar. We're in a week of interest rate announcements and decisions. There's, a broad belief that the Reserve Bank is not going to move. It doesn't need to cut interest rates any further. It'd be nice to get another 25 basis points, but we already are seeing a huge impact, certainly amongst lower income earners who are getting into the property market for the first time and buying up properties in the sort of up to the 3 million rand level. It's a good chunk of South Africa's property market. We are seeing the effect of lower interest rates. It certainly is stimulating economic activity. We also chat to Chris Skitter, the chief executive of Astral. The chicken business had its wings clipped quite significantly during lockdowns. We'll talk to him all about that coming up in a few minutes.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. It is good to be with you on this Tuesday evening. While the cat's away, the mice will play. As the Emirates has entered into a, what's called an interline agreement with FlySafair as part of its plans in South Africa. Emirates and FlySafair, they plan to make use of single-ticket travel. So you can, you know, if you are in George, for example, or somewhere else where there isn't a flight, an Emirates flight, then you can connect on FlySafair from PE or East London or George, either to Joburg, Cape Town or Durban, from which Emirates does fly, and you can book your bags all the way through. So yeah, one man's meat is another man's murder, they say. Old-fashioned statement. Somebody else goes through misery, in this case SAA, and there are others to pick up the slack, and that's really encouraging. On your next Money Show, Peter Armitage, the founder and chief executive of Anchor Capital, will be in our investment school. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Discussing investment returns you can expect locally and globally. That'll be an interesting one. And also marketing advertising expert Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
It was a good explanation from Arthur Karras this evening. Not only that you and I had to go home and spend more time on our smartphones and on our iPads and on our laptops, and that would have led to an increase in data consumption, but many, many companies would have bought data bundles for staff to go home and work if they don't have access to broadband, and broadband penetration is still fairly low in South Africa. But it's what kept the country going during lockdown. Shamil Jussup is Group Chief Executive at Vodacom. And I often ask people this question, Shamil, about what would have happened to the country in the era of the Nokia 3310. That was probably the era of 2G. Maybe it was 1G. I don't remember that far back. But just how technology has prevented, you know, not only this country, but the world falling on its face during a pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed things considerably, right? If we had a lockdown in back then, I think it would have been an absolute disaster. At least now people could work and educate from home. And I think that's the power of broadband and data.
It most certainly is. The value of broadband and data, I think, has been truly expressed. And your 86% increase in data traffic year on year is testimony to that. I mean, forgive me for being really, I suppose, ignorant about this, but it's a case that I would have expected an even bigger increase in data. I mean, just is 86% exceptional in your view, considering what we have been through as a country?
I think it is. I mean, remember, we're starting off from quite a big base, and then, you know, 86%, you know, almost doubling the amount of traffic on the network is quite extraordinary. And, of course, that comes from a 64% increase in average usage per smartphone device, but also a lot of free traffic, you know, from free sites and basically a lot of the assistance that we provided under COVID.
Talk to me about how the network held up. I mean, you did have an outage on Friday, and lots of people are very grumpy about that. But the networks did seem to hold up fairly well.
Yeah, I think, besides the outage, which had nothing to do with the increase in traffic as such, I'd say we held up pretty well, particularly because what we did was we realized that we were going to have a crisis and that traffic was going to increase, so we front-ended a lot of our investment. We also, you know, had different challenges. I mean, one of the challenges, obviously, being able to build during lockdown. And secondly, the other issue was the power outages. So we spent about R1 billion on batteries to ensure, that the networks could stay up despite the power cuts.
I mean, that R1 billion on batteries, there's been a huge amount of capital expenditure during this period of time. You spent about R5 billion. A fifth of that, 20% of that, was on batteries. Just batteries because of Eskom's failure to provide sufficient electricity as we came out of lockdown. And also, I mean, there's a huge amount, as I understand it, in the mobile industry of theft of these batteries. And, I mean, a lot of that will be replacement, won't it?
Correct. So we lose probably close to $150 million a year in battery theft. Of course, we're trying to get smarter in terms of how we do it to curb the theft. We've gone back to what I call old school, which is essentially putting epoxy and cut glass
around the batteries, so that, you know, grinders break and so on. So just to try and curb the theft of batteries, but also using kind of geolocation capabilities to try and, you know, if the batteries leave the sites, that they then get locked and can't be used. But that will take time because you've got, 14,000 sites that you need to do it on.
Yeah, it's a hell of a policing job. I mean, is there any indication as to where the syndicates that are involved in this, where the batteries travel to? In a country where there's power shortages, I'm sure there's a market here, but there'd also be markets north of our borders, I'm sure.
Yes, there is. And I mean, you would have noticed recently there was one, there was a reported case where, working with the South African police services, that they managed to crack a ring, which actually was exporting the batteries into Zimbabwe. And then working with the Zimbabwean authorities, basically arrested the individuals involved.
Yeah, and that activity is important, of course. The fiber race is picking up really nicely. I mean, are you seeing it? Is there a significant breakthrough in terms of fiber acceptance and the ability to get more fiber into more homes?
Yes, I think, fiber is growing. And what was particularly important, I think, for all fiber providers during this period is you saw a bigger uptake of fiber to the home. So I think across the board, all fiber providers did see a nice uplift. And we saw a massive increase in both our ISP part of fiber, but also the connection rate on our own fiber footprint. That said, to be honest, I think we need to do more in the fiber space as a country, because we need to increase the amount of fiber. And we are looking at how we increase our presence in fiber through both organic and inorganic opportunities.
Is that where the growth is going to come from, in fiber? Or do you see more growth coming through as in 4 and 5G? You're partnering, I think, with Rain as well, in terms of this desire to bring 5G to the market?
To be frank, I don't see it as one or the other. I see it as both. I think we need to see both fiber grow exponentially in the country, and we need to see mobile connectivity through 5G and 4G also grow exponentially. And we've got to get people off the 2G and 3G network using 4G because, of course, from a cost perspective, it's much more optimal to use the newer technologies than it is to use the older technologies.
In this lockdown, we had some of the broadband government spectrum freed up as an emergency measure. What is the status there?
So the auctions plan for March, of course, the temporary spectrum provided some relief. The auction is in March, and I think it's important that gets delivered for us to be able to cope with the increase of traffic. And then secondly, I think the digital migration, which is the broadcasters such as yourselves, moving off the spectrum is also key for us to be able to fully utilize that. So even when the spectrum auction happens, that spectrum won't be available immediately, or not all of it. The digital migration has to be cast in stone in terms of a definitive date for us to get full benefit of that spectrum.
But the point is that it was possible, and it just happened seamlessly. And I mean, one wonders the reasons for these perpetual delays.
Yeah, look, I think there's lots of history on the delays. I think what's encouraging is that, ICASA has made good progress, and everything is aligned for the auction to happen in March.
We hope so. We certainly do. Shamil Jessup, thank you. Group Chief Executive at Vodacom.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
An incredible day on stock markets today. I'll update you on that just after Eyewitness News, as markets have gone completely bananas. It's a technical term. It's a bit of jargon, really, about markets, as we see another vaccine solution ready for market. Well, profits under pressure at the chicken producer Astral Foods in the year to the end of September. Big chunk of the year hit by COVID. So despite revenues going up by 5%, profits were sharply down, but it wasn't all COVID. It wasn't all the slowdown of COVID. There was lots of trouble in the mix already. The municipality at Standerton, for example, had failed to deliver water, and Chris Skitter, a chief executive at Astral, had to get hot and heavy with the municipality there. And I mean, just so many issues and so many fires to put out on any single day, Chris Skitter. A lot of COVID effects coming through in these results, but also a lot of infrastructure failure coming through and really hurting you, I think.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, you mentioned we were under pressure. I think we're always under pressure. We established most of our operations in the historic past in the rural areas because that was the right thing to do from an agri perspective, is to be close to your raw materials and close to your rural workforces. Now, that turns against you when government fails to manage their municipalities or the third level of government. And the Standerton municipality is just an absolute mess. We're trying our best to become self-sufficient. And if you can't become self-sufficient in rural, smaller towns, not all of them, of course, you either have to become self-sufficient or ship out. And the same with Standerton. We've spent some capital there to have our own water produced from a reverse osmosis plant. And hopefully in a year's time, we will have a 7-kilometer water pipeline just for Astral from the Vaal River. And these are the extents you have to go to manage a business in South Africa, which our counterparts abroad don't have to obviously deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Added on top of that, COVID came along, and for example, fast food, a lot of chicken is consumed via the KFCs of the world, for example, and for a while there was absolutely zero trade there. What did that do to your business?
Yeah, that was wonderful. We were never a big in that market sector. It was about 5-6% of Astral's total business, so not a big share of our business, but it was a big share of our competitors' business. And with that sudden lockdown, of course, of the QSR market, our competitors had overnight nowhere to go with their chicken. So the first thing you do is obviously to try and sell it fresh in other markets till that market is saturated. And then the only option left is to go the IQF or the frozen route. And then you put it in cold storage till that's filled to the brim, and then you have to discount. So we were caught in the crossfire there between the QSR market's lockdown and our competitors re-entering the QSR market. That obviously had downward pressure on prices. It was a royal time for the retail chains and a very good time for consumers to buy chicken below the price of 18 to 20 months ago.
Yeah, and that is a big breakthrough. And of course, another upside as far as your industry would be concerned, there was a time where no imports were coming in. So there wasn't the extent of the dumping that you've often complained about in the past. We didn't see too many of those big chicken imports.
Yeah, if we do a like-for-like comparison in line with Astral's reporting period, imports were down only 10%, and that's a bit disappointing after all the hard work to get this poultry sector master plan in place with the minister and to negotiate from 82% to a 62% import tariff, but up from 37%, and it only impacted imports by 10%. That was a bit of a negative on that whole master plan. So we're going back to the minister and say, the level that we have promulgated and what you've offered was not sufficient to curb dumping. What we see now and what I've been talking about over many years, Bruce, is this is now evidence that it's classic dumping. Doesn't matter what you do with the import tariff, they keep on dropping their price below their production cost in for instance, Brazil, and just dump the chicken somewhere else, which is against the technical rules of the WTO. And South Africa needs to create jobs. And that was the negotiations with the minister at the time. You give us a sufficient import duty, we will spend the money this side on capital projects to produce the chicken locally and to create jobs. Well, we've done our part. Astral on its own has spent close to R1 billion over the past year and a half on capital projects. We've done our bit, but the imports is still with us, although 10% lower, but it's still there, making up 27% of total consumption in South Africa, which on its own is bigger than Astral's share in South Africa.
Astonishing. Chris Kutter, thank you. Chief Executive at Astral Foods.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. We're waiting for Jean Villers this evening, who is the Managing Director of Nielsen Sports SA. Some really interesting thoughts about sponsorships, sports sponsorships coming up. We've also got our regular book reviewer, Ian Mann from Gateways Business Consultants. He's been reading Tim Harford, the Financial Times economist and author. His latest book is How to Make the World Add Up. Everything from remote work to online shopping to COVID-19, huge accelerator of trends. And it's fabulous insight into how the world really works. And Tom Harford is the expert at explaining it all. And he's a naughty economist. I don't know, can you be a naughty economist? But he's a witty and cheeky and very, very productive economist, let's put it that way. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. That, and of course, Doris Atole coming up later, the former food editor, True Love magazine, on Other People's Money.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
I was chatting to some people in sport the other day, and they were saying most sponsors of South African sports bailed on their commitments in hard lockdown. They just went, tough, sue us if you want to, but, you know, we won't be there for you later. If you do take action against us, there is no live sport. We're not paying you money. And the sporting codes have really, really suffered. One or two sponsors have gone stuck through. I'm told SAB has been very good. South African Breweries has been incredibly good about its commitments throughout this pandemic. There weren't any games, of course, and so the impact on sport has been absolutely enormous. Nielsen today publishing the first sponsorship outlook report. Jean Villers is the Managing Director at Nielsen Sports South Africa. Before we look forward, just a quick look back, Jean, at the year that has been. It's probably the worst year in history, certainly modern history, for all sport.
Yeah, fascinating times in the sport and sponsorship and entertainment industry at the moment, Bruce. It's interesting times. I think from a brands, rights holders, agencies point of view, we were almost moving in a direction of unstoppable and just continually every year rights fees just growing and growing and growing. And so maybe this is what our industry needed, just to relook at ourselves and relook at what are the objectives of what we're trying to get out of the industry and what are brands trying to get out of sponsorship and what are rights holders doing right and wrong.
Had the sort of relationship lost its way in terms of, you know, what sponsors wanted versus what the sports could provide and with what audiences could provide for sponsors and for the sports themselves?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, taking a look at the research that we've done from a brand point of view and what brands are trying to achieve with their sponsorship, there seems to be a massive disconnect between what brands are trying to achieve and what rights holders are trying to achieve. And that communication lines have tended to fade over the years. And so we hopefully COVID as can become a bit of a catalyst and we can get the industry back on track in some way, shape or form, even though we've lost a massive amount of money out of the industry.
What must happen for it all to recover?
Communication. Communication, I guess, is the key between all the parties involved and the sponsorship industry. And we're seeing a big takeout from the study is that brands are really looking to get flexibility in their rights contracts. So flexibility, not necessarily trying to get out of their rights contracts or trying to get out of their contracts, but flexibility in the rights that they purchase. You know, you don't want to buy just a logo next to the field or a logo on a rugby jersey. You need to be flexible with what you're offering as a rights holder now for the enormous amount of money that brands are expected to pay in terms of the rights fees that they need to cough up for the specific rights that they're buying. So we need to have more communication. We need to have really clear communication and clear objectives being set by the brands. And then the big thing that comes out of it is being flexible. And now is a better time, no better time now to be flexible than COVID has put us in a situation where gone are the fans at the stadiums, gone is the hospitality, gone are all the activations that we can do at stadiums. We've moved into the digital world, digital and social, and TV is linear TV and so-called the streaming side of things is becoming more and more important for sports fans to consume their sports. And so how you leverage your sports fans now sitting at home or watching with a few friends and family and, not being able to fill up your stadiums anymore. That's I guess, is a big risk.
How scary is the future for sport and for sports sponsorship? Because the sport certainly can't exist without money.
Yeah, definitely. Sports relies massively on sponsorship, probably second behind the broadcast rights fees that they get from their broadcasters. And so essentially, at least the matches are still being played for now. We've seen two rugby games in South Africa already being postponed or cancelled, called off because of COVID. And so, it's a risk from a rights fee point of view, from a broadcast point of view. If you take away your broadcast rights fees, which at the moment are still looking around, but from a sponsorship point of view, brands are under massive pressure. I mean, you would know, brands are not just from a sponsorship point of view, but from a marketing side and staff cutting side. How do you justify spending 100 million or 80 million on a sponsorship if you've cut 2,500 jobs at a certain brand? So that's the crux of it, is that we've got to really be smart with where we're spending our sponsorship money and where we're making sure that every rand that we tick over is really delivering for us as a brand and making sure that the sponsorship properties that we've got in the markets are delivering and giving us those return on investments and return on objectives and making sure that at the end of the day when we have to pitch to our board and we have to say this is why we want to renew a certain sponsorship with a certain rights holder, you've really got to have your facts straight and you've got to show that it's made a massive sales impact or you've changed the narrative in South Africa around your brand and your brand love. So, yeah, scary times for brands and for rights holders at the moment. We're saying close to half the industry is saying that it's going to take more than 12 months for the industry to recover. It could potentially be longer than that. And what is the new normal? What is that recovery after 12 months?
So many sports were struggling for support. So many, more marginal sport. There were sports that draw less public attention, and so much of women's sport also, whether it be women's cricket or whatever the sporting discipline might be, were already struggling. I mean, does this put some of these sports at risk, do you think?
It massively does. I mean, if you are a sport that relies on either people to come to your stadium and you're not one of the mainstream sports that has got, daily or weekly television coverage, if you rely on the kind of niche audience to come to your events, it puts massive pressure on you. Massive pressure back on the government, massive pressure back on the likes of SASCOC to fund the so-called smaller sports and make sure that they stay alive. We can see in 12 months from here and some of the sports have completely disappeared where, we've got school kids that are not playing sports at school. We can have a whole year or two go by where some of the niche, smaller sports completely go missing if they're not played and participated. The mass participation sports, for example, are at massive risk. It's easy if you are watching the PSL or the rugby and it's on TV, but we forget about some of the smaller sports. On the women's side, I think it's a global push at the moment. The women's sport and women's sports and investing into women's sports is not just, it's not just seen as a CSR project anymore. It's now a proper return on investment, and some brands are really, pulling out of some of the men's sponsorships and backing the women and saying, this is not just money that I'm giving to charity anymore. I'm really going to see an investment here. We're seeing Banyana are performing well at World Cups, well at AFCONs, winning trophies. You know, so the questions are starting to be asked about women's sports and the performance that's being delivered from a women's sport point of view. It's not being seen anymore as a, you know, woman versus man sport. It's now being seen as this is a sponsorship opportunity, an opportunity for me to leverage my marketing budget. And so I'm not going to just give it the CSR side anymore. This is now a proper focus for me.
Is the future of sports sponsorship fundamentally different from its history? Because it is history now.
It's definitely going to, it's constantly changing. And where do we go? You know, no one knows. No one knows what to predict in the next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. Everyone is trying their best to look at history and make some form of prediction of what's going to take place. But it's very difficult to make any form of predictions of what the future looks like of sports sponsorship and how it looks. The one thing that's definitely changed is the digital and social media side, where 10 years ago we probably didn't see such a fundamental and really strong digital and social presence in the sponsorship space globally. And then the streaming side, probably not in South Africa yet. Linear TV and the free to airs in South Africa are still very powerful and the you know, people consuming their content in that space. But the streaming side of things globally across Europe and in the States is definitely picking up. And we're seeing, you know, the likes of the niche sports, as we mentioned earlier, even things like golf, where some people would say it's a niche sport, you know, in certain areas of the world, the content and the rights and the broadcasts and rights around golf is starting to be discussed and it can become a very niche space. So the streaming side, the digital side, definitely a massive one too that's on the up. From a broadcast or from a rights holder point of view, you've got to be flexible. You know, we're not sure what we can deliver in January 2021. So when we're signing rights contracts now, we've got to make sure that the rights contract doesn't say two Twitter posts and one Instagram post. It's got to be flexible around what that brand is looking to achieve from that sponsorship.
Got you. Jean Villiers, thank you. Managing Director at Nielsen Sports South Africa. Fascinating insights into the world of sports sponsorships.
The Money Show.
Business books.
So how do you make the world add up? Well, the well-known global economist Tim Harford writes for, amongst others, the Financial Times, does a show on BBC Radio 4. We've chatted to him on this show about his podcast, about the inventions that changed the world. Well, he's written a brand new book, How to Make the World Add Up. Ian Mann, our regular book reviewer, managing director at Gateways Business Consultants. I think you like this one, Mr. Mann.
I like this very much, and I'll tell you why. We are confronted by numbers all the time, and we have to be able to make sense of these things. And what he's done is he's come up with 10 rules. I like the 10 thing because everybody says 10 of this and 10 of that and 10 commandments. He's got 10 rules that he suggests that people follow when they're confronted with numbers, and we're confronted all the time. So let me just share with you a couple of the rules, and you'll see why this is such a great idea. He says the very first thing when you're confronted with a number is to check your emotional response. Now there are lots of things that have no emotional response at all, and then all you have to do is just evaluate them. Somebody tells you, for example, that Mars is 15 million kilometers from Earth right now, and you have no emotional response. By the way, that's completely incorrect.
But I was about to Google it, actually.
it's about 80, and it changes between 60 and 80 because the way the Mars moves. But you don't have any emotional response. So what you should do is just evaluate it, check your Google, and see whether this stuff is true or not. But there are other things that we're confronted with that actually we have a visceral response to them. For example, when the evidence came out that coffee is another source of caffeine that could increase the risk of women developing breast cysts. The evidence, I think everybody would agree, was quite convincing. But women who drank a lot of coffee, they were not that convinced. When evidence supports our preconceptions, we're much less likely to look for flaws. When it doesn't support it, then we do. You know, think of political activists. If you want your politician to be smart and witty and incorruptible, you probably are inclined to dismiss or ignore any contrary evidence. It seems to be like this. When we see something that we dislike, we ask ourselves, must I really believe this? And if we approve of it, we say, can I believe this? And so we have a completely different response. I think that it's quite important. He says, what do you feel when you see a stat? And that should indicate to you that something is going on here. So I think that's one of his 10. And I think that that's a very, very good idea. Another one of his 10 is to say, we need to combine the bird's eye view with the worm's eye view. The bird's eye view is the bigger macro picture that we're told by the stats, but very often there's a worm's eye view, which is the way I see it. I mean, just consider this way. We know that heavy smoking causes a 16 times greater risk of getting lung cancer. Now, you've got a 90-year-old grandmother, and she's healthy as anything, been smoking like a chimney her whole life. The only person you actually know who died of lung cancer is is your next-door neighbor's uncle who has never smoked a cigarette in his life. Now, your personal experience tells you one thing and statistics tell you another, and they're both true. And this is what psychologists call naive realism, but it sometimes has really important implications. I'll share one really important implication. There's a vaccine against measles, mumps, and rubella. It's called MMR. And the vaccines are administered at about the same age as autism is generally detected in children. There's two doses that they give. And on these, about the time that the doses are given, it's the time that they usually seem to pick up autism in kids. Now, a lot of people believe that the vaccines themselves cause autism. And what they've done is many people, and there was even a movement towards doing this, refusing to have your children vaccinated against really dangerous diseases. And if you look at, there was a Danish study that was done on 650,000 kids. That's huge, 650,000. Some of those kids had been vaccinated. Some of them had not been vaccinated. In both groups, the vaccinated and the non-vaccinated, autism was 1% of the total of each group. So it doesn't appear that vaccines make any difference at all on scientific basis, based on this really big study. But when you were told that your child is autistic, and just a week or two ago you had the jab for measles, mumps, and rubella, and people are saying that this one causes the other, it does make you very nervous.
It's a perfectly natural conclusion to leap to. And I think when we're under distress and we're stressed and we're tense, our biases are firing on all cylinders, if a bias can fire on a cylinder. And anything that rings true becomes fact, because we are absolutely primed to believe it as fact because it suits us to do so.
Our personal experience seems to confirm that this is correct, as opposed to objective. And that's where we have to look at these two things. You have to look at the bird's eye view as well as the worm's eye view. He has a whole bunch of others. I'd like to share some with you. One of the interesting ones he comes up with is that we have to assume a perspective. And as a newsman, you'll appreciate this. You've got rolling business news coverage on Bloomberg, and then you have that's rolling, and then you have daily news in the Financial Times, and then you have the weekly take of The Economist. Now, Bloomberg might pick up on a very sharp market move that happened in the past hour, but barely gets a mention in The Economist at the end of the week. And then you might have, that's three different rhythms. Even if you spread the rhythms out further, and you said that's a 25-year rhythm, so imagine reading a newspaper that only comes out once every 25 years. The newspaper would not mention the killing spree in London, the headline in all the dailies. It would only mention in a 25-year newspaper the rise of China, the World Wide Web, maybe the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And if you expand this still further, you'll see the point. If you expand this still further, say to a 200-year newspaper, the headline might scream, poverty has been overcome. Newspaper came out this year, and it's the headline is poverty has been overcome. But we know that there's 6 to 7 million extremely poor people living on under $1.90 a day, which is real poverty. Six to 700 million people living like that. And here's a headline that says poverty has been overcome. The reason why a newspaper that comes out every 200 years would have a headline, poverty has been overcome, because 200 years ago, 18 out of every 20 people on the planet lived on $1.90 a day equivalent. So when we have to see things in perspective. One of the nice things he mentions is we should carry around a few landmark numbers. I suppose it depends on what industry you're in and where you come from. But you want some landmark numbers that allow you to compare whether the number you're seeing is a big number or a little number. So, for example, you might say that the population of the U.S. is 325 million, the U.K. is 65 million, and there's 7.5 billion people on the planet. How about Botswana? And you know, Botswana, in perspective, is minuscule. So when we have something to compare things against, it's quite important. It allows us to answer how big a number is this really.
It's critical to get that. So numbers are all about perspective. I mean, numbers in isolation are meaningless. Numbers that can provide perspective are valuable. I mean, it's just when you're comparing, I don't know, stats from different countries, and you suddenly go, oh, my goodness me, that country has had 100 murders. What a lovely country. Well, if the country was the Vatican, it would be putting a completely different spin on things, for example. Numbers in isolation are designed either to dazzle or to confuse or to deliberately obfuscate. And numbers have always got to be challenged, haven't they?
All the time. One of the areas that I'm seeing a lot of is people getting very excited about big numbers. And the idea is that we can use algorithms and big data that drives the algorithms that drive the big data. And we don't have to know too much about them. We can just look at this and say, there's amazing stuff. The problem is that he says without transparency, you can't trust big data. And let me just explain what I mean. In 2009, researchers at Google came up with a remarkable achievement. Without a single test, they could tell the spread of influenza across the United States quicker than the Centers for Disease Control. And this, by the way, was reported in Nature, which is a very, very top-end journal. And what they said was that by looking at what people were looking up during the time of a flu epidemic, they could tell that from the searches where the flu was moving around to and how much of it was going on. And it was quite an amazing achievement that you, without actually a single test from a doctor, you could make these sort of conclusions. And Wired magazine, pretty much the same a year before that, it said, with enough data, the numbers speak for themselves. Now, if the numbers can speak for themselves, that would be quite staggering. A few years later, Google's claim was retracted because it had been based on a correlation. And the correlation was false. It was shown to be false only later. So they withdrew the stuff. What happened was they were estimating flu and based on correlations which correlated also to basketball, because basketball and flu happened in the middle of November. And when flu came out in the summer, their numbers were four times were out by a factor of four. The thing about big data is that the claim that big data allows numbers to speak for themselves is a fallacy. Statisticians over the last 200 years have been trying to work out what traps lie in wait when we try to understand the world through data. And then traps don't disappear because you've got a lot of data. In fact, they just get worse. And I think that behind this, if all the ideas that he comes up with in this book is just this, that we want to be able to believe numbers that we see, because numbers are important and they allow us to understand the world. But we've got to trust them. And well-placed trust grows out of active inquiry rather than blind acceptance. And his point is, all throughout the book, is be curious, check, think through things. And these rules are a way of uncovering a lot of things, a lot of fallacies that we could come across and a lot of traps we could fall into.
Final question for you this evening, Yaman. How far is Mars away today?
Exactly, I would say it's about 80 million kilometers, give or take. How close am I?
Not bad, actually. 82 1,839,000 kilometers away. That's how far away Mars is. As of this moment, yesterday you may have been right. Ian Mann, thank you very much indeed. Ian Mann from Gateway's Business Consultants, reviewing Tim Harford's latest book, Making Sense of the World with Numbers.
The Money Show.
Other People's Money.
Other People's Money, brought to you by Satrix Investing Global Funds. Invest with Satrix. Welcome this evening to Dora Sitole, the former food editor of True Love magazine. It's been a 40-year love affair professionally with food, Dora Sitole. But, I mean, you growing up in Nigel, there was very little in the house and you guys were always hungry. And I think that's been a shaping influence on you throughout this career with food, hasn't it?
Yes, Bruce, I should say so. Yeah, whenever I think back to my past, I do think of those years when there was hardly any food.
It's tough. Absolutely. And I mean, the love affair with food grows and is remarkable. Tell me about growing up in Nigel when you did. I'm not going to ask for dates, but I'm sure it was pretty tough.
Well, the fact that the the book is like 7 decades of my life, you can actually tell where that time was. I grew up with my paternal parents, grandparents in Nigel, my father's family. And it was all of us, cousins and aunts in one four-roomed house. And there wasn't much food to stretch for all of us, except for a small vegetable patch that my aunt used to have at the back. And in summer, that's where we would actually have accompaniment for our pup.
And that would be spinach in summer. What came out of the garden in winter?
In winter, basically not much. So in winter, we probably most of the days had pap and tripe. Yeah. Or pap and tomato and onion gravy. And then you'd have to buy whatever you can from the shops, maybe cabbage, which was like a veggie of choice if it wasn't growing in the garden.
One of your first jobs was as a coding clerk. You were in a market research company, and it was fine. I don't think you liked it very much. But your husband then said to you, hey, there's this job going at Metal Box Industries. Is Metal Box even still going? I don't think it is.
It was bought over by Nampec.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you for that update. I remember Metal Box Industries from Funder Bale Park many, many years ago. They had a cool job for you. And your husband said, nobody else in the world, and he's not just speaking as a husband, he was objective about this, said, nobody cooks quite like you. You're a fantastic cook, and they need a cooking demonstrator. Had you ever cooked for anybody on a large scale before, other than family members?
Not at all, except for when I was assisting my dear friend, Sis Iris, when she was cooking for big weddings in Soweto, and I would just tag along and cook with her. So... But me, I hadn't, like, I didn't have the confidence yet, but I had learned a lot from Sis Iris, and I was trying all those recipes on my family and friends.
It's very different, though. I mean, preparing a meal for 100 people is a big ask. It's huge. But preparing a meal for 100 people in front of 100 people is considerably different. And you were leapt straight into demo cooking, which must be an incredibly stressful environment.
It was stressful for me because, I mean, naturally I'm an introvert. So being thrown into that was quite daunting. But you know what? For me, it was like I need to do this. If I'm busy with my hands, I don't have to look at people, so I'll be fine. So I think my very first demo was at a high school in Tembisa. I had to demonstrate to a home economics class of, I think it was standard 8. And it went off so smoothly. The teacher was so supportive, and I kept going to that school for a number of years even after that. And during school holidays, I'd host like workshops for them at the True Love Kitchen. So yeah, I slowly kind of got used to speaking in front of crowds. But I think even now, I'd rather be doing something in front of a crowd than just looking at them and saying something.
Yeah. It's nice that you can hide. You're in your comfort zone, aren't you? I mean, have you got a favorite recipe? Because you've written books about cooking from Cape to Cairo, and you've sampled great food from across this continent. Is there a particular style that gets you more than any other?
You mean style in terms of styling food?
It's in the style of food. I mean, or cultural food. Do you like Moroccan food? Do you like Ethiopian food? What appeals to you? What sort of country's food suits you best?
It's for me. It's like robust, kind of generous food. Like you can see through my book, you know, there isn't like any fine dining. I'm really into huge amounts of food. And so that's why African food appeals to me so much, because, I mean, it's not about smaller amounts, but it's about sharing and giving and being generous.
The Moroccans love sharing, and many other sort of North African cultures are very big on that too. Talk to me then about the move to True Love, because you spent an awfully long time at True Love as the food editor. Was that how did that job come about?
I was at the Canned Food Advisory Service Metrobox for 7 years, and then got headhunted to go and join Media 24 as, it was called Drum Publications, and it was True Love, City Press and Drum Magazine. So I joined them as group food editor for the three publications, but with special attention to True Love Magazine, because at that stage, I think Naspers wanted to turn True Love Magazine into a strong women's brand, because prior to that, it was more of a general interest magazine. So I was brought in to try and to grow that side of the magazine, hence the True Love Demonstration Kitchen. And so I did all the food pages actually increased. They increased also because the advertisers also came into the magazine in numbers.
And that's, I think, a sign of success. I mean, it's an acknowledgement that you hit a mark, and you were, these publications are absolutely huge in terms of influence. I mean, even the days before social media, you were an influencer. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yes, I believe so. It's quite interesting. It's an interesting title, but I believe I was an influencer at that stage.
You see, today you could have charged a fortune for that. You could have charged a fortune to be that influencer today.
Yeah. I could be getting money in bags.
No, but that's politics. That's a different kind of influence. Dora Sitole is our guest this evening, the former food editor at True Love magazine. She's had a true love and a long career in food. That career in food starts at Metalbox Industries and culminates with the editorship of the food pages at True Love magazine. I want to talk to her about money in a moment, because she is the original influencer when it comes to food, yet she didn't coin it as a result of her influence. So let's see how she does manage money in a bit.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Did you do well out of food, Dora Sitole, former food editor at True Love magazine? Are you, did you have, and again, we don't mention numbers and we don't pry into salaries, into the total of investments or anything like that, because that's deeply personal. You can share if you want to. But do you think you did financially well? I mean, did you exceed your own expectations through your career, from being the clerk to the demo cook to being South Africa's food influencer?
I believe so. Given the time, during that time, I mean, salaries were quite bad. And I remember when I was leaving my previous company to join Canned Food Advisory Service, my salary actually doubled. And during the interview, even the lady who was interviewing me, Gail Glover, was actually surprised at what I was earning. So But I couldn't, I didn't know, I couldn't judge. I didn't know how much other people earned, but she was definitely like, wow, I'm going to double that. And on top of that, you're getting a company car. And those were the days when we used to have free company cars. It would be a brand new car that basically belonged to you and was looked after by the company. So over and above the salary that I was getting, I was going to get a company car as well. So giving the times, I think I was doing very well compared to my peers there.
Those were the days, cars included in the package. Now, did you, when your salary doubled, did you start saving money? Or were you like all of us and went, yee-hee, my salary has doubled, it's time to go shopping?
Well, I think when I joined Metalbox, I already had my first son. So I already had responsibilities at home. But my husband was doing quite well. So there wasn't really much demand on my salary per se, but just to contribute as much as I could to help him. But I've always believed in saving. I don't know if you remember unit trusts. Obviously, you were.
Of course, unit trusts are still in existence. They still exist, or
they still are. I still have unit trusts even now, because for some reason I've never let go of unit trusts. They've always been like for me, like you know that comfort blanket that money that you forget about, and you can go into when days are really dark.
And have you ever had a need to call on those unit trusts, or have you allowed them to sit and to mature and to grow, and hopefully they've done well for you?
No, sadly not, because I've really had a lot of challenges throughout my life. I mean, when my children were in school, they were in private schools, so it used to cost a lot. So I'd from time to time dig into them. But I've never let them go. Even now, like I say, you know, I always like try to forget about them completely, and I would really just go into them when times are really bad.
And what got you into investing? I mean, how did you meet a financial advisor? What were you doing? Reading Bruce Cameron's column in the Saturday Star. What got you investing?
I don't even remember what, because it was. With my first job, when I started at Metalbox, that's when I started having unit trusts. And it could have been just discussions amongst us young people, because I had them before I even got married. And when I got married, that money came quite handy. And then I just continued. And yeah, like I say, even now I still have them. I don't think anyone else is. I don't know if people still do unit trust, but I've just stayed with the same company over the years. And it's not a lot of money, but it's money that does help me when I'm really like in a fix.
So you've not ever taken advice then as to whether you should be reviewing the investment, whether or not you should be, how well it's done relative to other assets in the world? I mean, have you ever done comparisons? Do you obsess about that sort of thing?
No, I haven't. You know what? I actually like probably don't think I have. I have a feeling like I live from hand to mouth. So for me, it's like having a financial advisor. You really need to be in big monies. I might be wrong, but that's how I feel. So when I get my statement for my unit trust, I just read through it, and whatever they write, they make sense to me. So I've never like. Explored and to see what else is out there.
Are you still working? I mean, you're writing, yes, but are you still sort of earning money on a monthly basis in any way?
Well, I do freelance work. One of my big clients is Tiger Brands. I do food styling for them and writing, developing recipes. So from time to time, I would earn from that. This year has been quite bad with COVID, but I think things will open up again. But that kept me busy. I mean, all the years I took early retirement at 57, and then all these years I've been like freelancing, and it's been good. I've been quite busy. I also like do writing from time to time for publications that require my services.
I mean, and that's it's a huge thing, going freelance at the age of 57 and choosing to do so, and doing that work, because again, you said seven decades earlier, so let's say you're 70-ish, and to still be productive and to still be earning it's very, I mean, it's commendable to still be earning an income, because so many people, by the time they get to 70, are either so fed up or so tired or just can't anymore. And you've kept your health and you're continuing to be productive and to maintain the hustle.
Yes, I'm lucky in that I've got a skill that you could actually utilize into your old age. So I think for me, just being in the background, developing recipes, doing food styling, that suffices. And I do have that skill, and I do have clients that demand that. So I'm quite lucky in the sense that I do have a skill that I can still utilize.
What's the best thing you've learned about money over your life?
Sure, that you have to respect money. And that money just goes through your hands like soap, you know. So when you have it, you've got to plan for it. And because I just remember I learned quite a harsh lesson when I took my early retirement. I got quite a handsome payout. And I think I should have taken advice then.
Yes.
to use it wisely. And that's something that I would say to most people, that when you get that package, just sit down and plan for it properly.
Do you regret what you did with your money? I'm assuming you had a bit of a good time and you spent it.
I don't regret, because a lot of it went into upgrading my home. Okay. And I now sit comfortably in a beautiful home. So, yeah, and the house is paid off and it's quite a good property. But I think in renovating, I could have sat down with someone and just did proper budgeting. I don't think I did that. I think I spent more than I had planned to. So it really dug into my earnings. But then, I mean, my house is looking good, so I don't really regret it.
And yeah, we've all spent a lot more time at home than we'd intended over the last year. So it's useful that it's beautiful. Do you have any bad habits? Do you buy ingredients that, you know, imported tinned tomatoes or something terrible, some terrible money crime that you want to share with us tonight? The thing that you know you shouldn't do, but you do anyway.
I never thought of it as crime, but I do overshop, especially food.
Oh, dear.
And I tend to buy expensive ingredients. I'm like, it's got to be the best, you know. So I'm more into the more top-end supermarkets to buy my food. And I buy a lot. I think I sometimes overshop. If I have a shoot, I don't compromise. I buy the best and I buy a lot. And I always end up with a lot of food, you know, after the shoot, which I need to freeze or maybe give away. So I think that's a bad habit, because I give away a lot of food.
It all depends on who you're giving it to, of course. I mean, sharing is caring, yes. Dora Sitole. Former editor, food editor at True Love Magazine, Dora Sitole, this evening. Thank you for sharing some money stories, some food stories with us this evening. It's been fabulous catching up. Dora Sitole this evening, freelancer, but previously food editor at True Love Magazine.